We have four of us, so we're going to go ahead and start, because a lot of this will go on the record and be valuable. We asked Public Health to give us a briefing on what to expect on the heart-rending disaster that's going on over there in Japan, and I think it kind of grew from there, and we've got lots of good information, I think, to put on the record today. We're hosting a presentation. This is not a official meeting. We can't make decisions because it wasn't noticed. It was noticed for Thursday, and we moved it back to Tuesday. So your money is safe today. You can just sit back and enjoy. I just want, before we start, I want to, just for perspective, if I can do a little bit of a rant here, having reliable and secure and affordable power has enabled us to improve public health in a lot of ways. I think we all know that. Pure drinking water, sanitation, food production, home heating, ventilation, lighting, all those things are very significant and helpful in the area of public health, and it all takes energy. the Japanese disaster can and probably will shape history because of the magnitude of the disaster. Even if the radiation from the power plants is handled and there's the deaths are held at a minimum and the sickness and all that, still it's going to profoundly affect us. And I think that's true on several levels. When you're talking the third largest economy in the globe, you know, and they're going to be hugely impacted. So you have that direct one, but indirectly you have the political stuff going on. The places where safety isn't as much a part of the culture as it is in the United States, like China, I think they have 27 reactors under construction at this time. They have 50 more planned. I doubt if they will. They may adjust some as we go, but I doubt if it'll stop any of that, of course. In Russia, also, yeah, they're in the process. They've been building floating nuclear power plant. I'm not sure where they're at. There's some stage of the development of that, and that gets pretty close to home because one of their goals is Eastern Russia, here in Alaska. So, anyway, the point is that the way it affects us here in Alaska is not just a direct and immediate potential health hazard. I think it's really worthwhile to just try to sit back and get the whole picture in our head so we can make good policy decisions in the future. We have present today Representative Miller, Representative Seaton, Representative Vick, Representative Kertula, and myself, Representative Keller. I expect that there will be more joining us. And like I say, we've invited Public Health to kind of host this presentation, and we'll see where it goes from there. So Dr. Joe McLaughlin, if you'd come up and make a presentation, identify yourself before you speak so that our reporter can get it.
Yeah, well, go ahead. Well, thank you very much. My name is Dr. Joe McLaughlin, and I'm the chief of the Alaska Section of Epidemiology and the state epidemiologist. And so we really appreciate the opportunity to be here to inform you all, give you a little situational update on the nuclear crisis in Japan, and provide you all with a perspective of what the public health response would be in the threat of a radiation emergency. Before I go into all of that, though, I want to just say that there are three main points that I'd like to impart on you all today. If there could be only three, these would be the three. The first is that there is no immediate or anticipated threat for harmful levels of radiation to reach Alaska. Number two, Alaska's seafood is unlikely to be affected. And number three, this is an important reminder that all Alaskans should assemble a home emergency kit and a family response plan. In terms of the public health response to a radiation emergency, we have a number of primary duties, and some of those duties I have listed here. Our first duty is to inform the public, as well as healthcare providers and our partners, provide them with a situational update, and provide them with the tools they need to reduce their risk of radiation exposure. We also have a duty to protect the public from radiation exposure through a number of different mechanisms, including number one, sheltering in place and or providing evacuation recommendations. Number two, distribution of radiation medications such as potassium iodide. Number three, restricting consumption of contaminated foods, i.e. protecting the food supply. We also have a responsibility to decrease the psychological effects of radiation exposure in the population affected after radiation event occurs. And finally, perform long-term follow-up for exposed persons. And this involves case identification and tracking through the formation of a registry and providing access to care. Now, in terms of the present Japanese nuclear crisis, there have been a number of communication responses that have been involved so far from the perspective of the Department of Health and Social Services. We have responded to numerous media requests, and we've issued press releases and messages through social media outlets such as Facebook and Twitter. We've issued an epidemiology bulletin, which has gone out to over 900 people statewide, and it's primarily written for healthcare providers in mind. And through all of these media outlets, our principal messages have remained the same. Number one, there's no anticipated threat to the health of Alaskans. Number two, Alaskans should not be taking potassium iodide at this time. Number three, we are monitoring and we're communicating with local, state, and federal partners. And finally, once again, this is an important reminder that all Alaskans should be prepared for emergencies. Well, what can Alaskans do to be prepared for an emergency? Number one, they can create a home emergency supply kit. And within that kit, I've listed a number of items that we recommend folks to have. We also recommend creating a vehicle emergency supply kit and developing a family response plan and then practicing that plan. In terms of radiation monitoring here in Alaska, Alaska's monitoring stations continue to show normal background levels of radiation. We have five U.S. EPA monitoring stations in Alaska. Those that are currently reporting are located in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, and those that are soon to be reporting are located in Dutch Harbor and Nome. We also have a new monitor that has been placed in Juneau that provides beta radiation data. The old monitor only provided gamma radiation data. Now, if levels were to rise substantially, we would measure specific isotopes to determine if steps are needed in order to protect the public's health. And these data are available at the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services homepage, which is www.hss.state.ak.us. Now, in terms of the food supply, the U.S. FDA is closely monitoring the food supply. They are performing increased and targeted product sampling at the border. And just of note, FDA stresses that less than 4% of the U.S. imported foods come from Japan. Current models indicate that U.S. fishing waters will remain safe, and this is a quote from a recent FDA facts page that came out. Quote, the great quantity of water in the Pacific Ocean rapidly and effectively dilutes radioactive material, so fish and seafood are likely to be unaffected. I've provided this table for you all to just give you a little sort of comparison information regarding exposure to radiation. The left-hand column shows exposure in REM, and the right-hand column provides some notes and effects. I'll call your attention first to the second row, which is 0.0016 REM. Now, this is the average amount of radiation that's absorbed by a person each day. And if you move down to the next one, a chest X-ray will give you 0.04 REMs of exposure. Now, if you go down to the next one, this is the average amount of radiation absorbed per person per year. It's 0.6 REM. And if you have a gastrointestinal series at your at the hospital, that is 1.4 REM. Now, The maximum radiation reported at the main gate of the Fukushima Daiichi power plant was on March 15th, and that was an exposure level of 40 rem. Now I'll bring your attention back up to the first row, 0.00008. This is the amount of radiation that was reported in Tokyo on that day. Finally, in terms of the last two rows, this is where we start to see health effects from radiation exposure on the acute level. In the 5 to 50 rem range, the fetus and embryo can have slightly increased risk of malformations, growth, and IQ impacts, as well as failure to implant. In children and adults, you start to see blood chemistry changes, such as a decrease in white blood cell count. Now, when you get into the 50 to 90 rem range, that's where you actually start to see symptoms of acute radiation sickness, including nausea, fatigue, vomiting, and diarrhea, and hair loss as well. When you get up above 90 rem exposure levels, that's where you start to see more severe adverse sequelae. Now, what about the availability of radiation medications nationwide and in Alaska? Radiation medications are included in the Strategic National Stockpile. This is a national stockpile. The first row of medications, potassium iodide, Prussian blue, and DTPA, are all provided for people who have already been or could be exposed to radiation. And basically what they do is they try to minimize the potential for exposure internally, either through pulling radioactive materials out of the blood or preventing radioactive materials from entering the thyroid gland. The next row, antiemetics, Neupogen, and antibiotics are provided for people who are already suffering from acute radiation sickness. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will only deploy the Strategic National Stockpile if there's a credible threat. And at this point, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, no public health risks are expected from this disaster in the United States. In summary, there is no anticipated threat of harmful radiation exposure to Alaskans at this time. Alaska's seafood is unlikely to be affected, and all Alaskans should be prepared for disasters. And we provide more information, which is available at our website. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Is there any, Representative Miller, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate your very concise presentation and your reassurances. Do you happen to know, and this is an off-the-wall question, a few things that I've read online just in the past few days have used the measurement millisieverts instead of rads, rems. Do you know how they convert?
I do indeed. It can be a little bit confusing, but let me, through the chair, let me provide you with a conversion. Let's see. So one sievert equals 100 rem, which equals 1,000 millisieverts.
One sievert equals 100 rem?
100 rem.
Okay.
And that is 1,000 millisieverts. And that is also 1 million microsieverts. That's another unit of measure you might see.
All right. And then if I may ask one other follow-up question here, you did indicate that on March the 15th, the radiation exposure at the Fukushima power plant was about 40, and on that same, on that same date, it was the 0008 exposure level in Tokyo. Do you happen to know which way the wind was blowing that day?
Representative Miller, through the chair, I don't happen to know the answer to that question.
Okay. And likewise, do you happen to know if there was something more catastrophic to happen at the plant? I understand that a lot of this has to do with the wind and the altitude where any plume of radioactive materials might reach. At this point, do you know what any of those altitudes have been, whether it be through fire, steam, explosion, or just radiating out?
Representative Miller, through the chair, I don't know what the altitude was. There, we did hear from the U.S. EPA this morning that the situation in Japan was very different than, for example, the situation in Chernobyl, where there was a massive explosion and a fire that raged for 10 days. And basically, that heat kicked up all of the radioactive material very high up into the jet stream, and that has not occurred in Japan.
If you would, Dr. McLaughlin, just stay there. I just want to say, first of all, Representative Herron joined us for the record, but online we have a number of people to answer questions. We have some in the room, and so we'll just kind of play it by ear. If there's more questions, I have a few that have been forwarded to me, but we have Mary Carlson from the Military and Veterans Affairs, Homeland Security and Emergency Response, and also Brian Fisher from the same, and Dr. Jilly, who's from the Department of Public Health in the lab, and we have Greg Wilkinson, who is a public health, and he's a public information officer. If we get too wild, he'll straighten us out on how we should talk about this maybe, but and then we have Chris and Ryan from DEC online, and if I'm missing anybody, I'm sorry, but we've got a good array of people here to answer questions. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And looking at these exposure data, I mean, basically we just moved the decimal point one place to the right for if 1,000 millisieverts equals 100 rem. So a chest X-ray, instead of being 0.04 rem, would be 0.4 millisieverts. Is that correct? And then I guess the question is this measurement in absolute exposure? I mean, like a chest X-ray, I can see would be an absolute exposure, but where they're giving so much millisieverts that if not given a duration, I don't know how to correlate those two. Could you correlate for us the time duration that we're talking about and how that works in here?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that's a great question. And for example, when you see the 40 rem exposure, this is a per hour exposure, whereas the 0.04 rem exposure for a chest X-ray would be an immediate exposure. And then the 0.0016, now this is an exposure on a daily basis. And 0.00008, I believe that is the amount of radiation reported in Tokyo on an out per hour, the highest, I believe that was the highest exposure that they had in an hour.
So follow up. So the exposure here, let's say we're talking about the 5 to 50 or the where you would have some effect. That's 5 to 50. Is that per day, per hour, total exposure? And it doesn't matter how long the time it took you to get that. I'm just trying to.
Representative Seaton, through the chair. This is more of an acute exposure event in the 5 to 50 and the 50 to 90 range. So you would either be thinking of an acute blast type exposure or in a very short period of time, i.e. minutes to hours.
Okay, and one more follow-up. And so the 40, the maximum radiation reported at the main gate of the power plant was 40. That was, again, was that in it?
Through the chair, that was per hour.
Per hour.
Per hour.
Thank you, Chair.
Did you have a question?
I do. Hello. We met in the Community Media Affairs this morning. But I did think of a question since then. It's my understanding, and I'm a little confused about beta and alpha and gamma, that a flight from London, from New York to London, is the equivalent of a chest X-ray. Is that correct?
Through the chairperson, I can tell you that the amount of radiation absorbed from one flight from Dulles Airport to Tokyo is 0.06 millisieverts, and that would be the equivalent of 0.006 rem.
So that's quite a bit less than a chest X-ray.
Correct.
Thank you.
Wes?
Representative Biller, sure, go ahead.
You did mention that potassium, iodide, some of these other medications are part of the strategic stockpile. Do you happen to know anything about their potency or their shelf life and how long any of these may or may not have been sitting on the shelf?
Representative Miller, through the chair, in terms of shelf life, it's about 7 years is the average of what I've seen for shelf life. In terms of potency, basically the recommendation is that an adult would receive 130 milligrams per day, dosed daily, so for 24 hours.
And if I understand that correctly, the optimal time to ingest this is before you're exposed to radiation. Is that correct?
Representative Miller, through the chair, the optimal window is between 2 hours prior to exposure and 4 hours after exposure. When you start getting into the four-plus hour after exposure range, your efficacy, protective efficacy, diminishes. But there is always the consideration that there may be ongoing exposure. With potassium iodide, I just want to stress that potassium iodide does one thing, and that is it protects your thyroid gland from exposure to radioactive iodine. There are other medications such as DTPA and Prussian blue, which help prevent absorption of radiation. Say if a person is internally contaminated, they can help prevent absorption from the gut. A lot of people get it contaminated through eating contaminated foods, and they can basically pull that radioactive material, the contaminated material, out of the gut, and you eliminate it. So in those medicines are useful for other forms of radioactive nucleotides, such as cesium and others.
And since you mentioned it, wasn't cesium one of the things that they did find in the air around the Fukushima plant?
Representative Miller, through the chair, that's correct.
Representative Herron, and then Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being late. And in your previous slide, food supply, I'm assuming you had a discussion on U.S. fishing waters. And maybe this question is already asked, but I understand the U.S. fishing waters, but what about U.S. food supply that may become outside of fishing waters? You know, i.e. closer to the island of Japan. So what would, could you please explore that a little bit, please?
Representative Herron, through the chair, I think Kristen Ryan in the Department of Environmental Conservation would probably be the best person to respond to that question. And she's available.
Kristen, do you have a response?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Kristen Ryan, the Director for the Division of Environmental Health in the Department of Environmental Conservation. We're working closely with FDA, our Food and Drug Administration, to monitor food that comes into the U.S. and Alaska from Japan. They already have a random sampling program that they perform at the ports of import. And FDA is ramping up their radiation monitoring of imports from Japan at those locations. Does that answer your question?
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that response. I guess let's reach out a little farther then. Let's talk about just humans. So as a human race, how concerned would you be about food supply within the range of contamination by the reactor in Japan?
Representative Herron, through the chair, Japan is monitoring milk in particular near the facilities and are advising people if they're finding levels that are, they think, elevated to the point of being unsafe. I don't have specifics, but I have heard that they are seeing some elevated levels within a radius of one of the plants. and are advising people not to consume that milk, but the levels are still relatively low. It's more of a precaution, I think, at this point. So far, they aren't seeing levels extremely high in food products around the plant, but they are seeing elevated levels above background.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks. Thank you for being here. I just was homesick for about 6 days, so I watched a lot of this on TV. And one of the things I've been wondering about is particularly for the Arctic, and that is this similar to the persistent organic pollutants, that it will stay in the marine mammals? I'm just wondering what the long-term effect might be there.
Representative Kurtula, through the chairperson, I wonder if Dr. Byrne Gilley might be a good person to start with this one.
From the lab, Dr. Gilley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Dr. Byrne Gilley. I'm the director of the Alaska State Public Health Laboratory. The persistence of any of these materials in marine mammals is dependent upon the half-life of the radionuclide that we're talking about. With iodine, for example, the half-life is 8 hours. So we do not expect significant accumulation of radioactive iodine in marine mammals. Cesium, however, has a much longer half-life of 30-plus years. So there is a theoretical a probability that there may be some buildup in some marine mammals, and it also depends on very much how much actually gets dissolved in water, and how much the prey animals pick up, and the concentrations in those. There's quite a lot of factors that we don't quite understand yet, but from what we're getting from the Japanese government and how much radiation has leaked into the aquatic environment, and I think Dr. McLaughlin also said earlier, there's a great dilution factor in the ocean. Those probabilities remain extremely, extremely low at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Miller?
I don't know who to direct this to, so maybe you can sort this one out. I've been reading a few lines. We talk about radioactive iodine. I think most of us recognize that there's probably uranium being used in this thing, and now we're discussing the half-life of cesium. Cesium is something that I have heard has been radiated into the air. Where is the cesium coming from? Mm. Is this an integral part of the fuel, or is this something else?
Mm. Representative Miller, through the chair, I can attempt to respond to that. When radioactive uranium or plutonium are used in a nuclear power plant, they undergo a process called fission. And during fission, the large sort of parent molecule splits into two molecules. One is a little heavier and one's a little bit lighter. And depending on how the atom actually splits, you can get a variety of different radionucleotides that come out of that nuclear fission reaction. Examples include iodine 131 and cesium.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Back to freshman chemistry, right, Doctor? I heard early on that Alaska had plenty of medication. Where is it stockpiled? What would be the general process procedure for getting it out to the people that needed it?
Mr. Chairperson, I think Chris Laborde would be the best person to respond to that, our preparedness program manager for the Department of Health and Social Services.
You stay there, that'd be fine. Chris, if you would identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Chris Laborde. I am the preparedness program manager for the Department of Health and Social Services. Could you repeat the question one more time, just in all that time, just so I make sure I got it?
I heard early on that Alaska was in good shape in our iodine supply and medications and that. And I just, where Do we keep it? And what's the plan for getting it dispersed when there's an issue that arises?
All right, two things. We have, let me get my page here. We have for the state of Alaska what's called the Alaska Strategic National Stockpile. That's Alaska's plan to receive and distribute any medical countermeasures to the citizens and visitors of Alaska. We work this in conjunction with the U.S. CDC, Center for Disease Control, with their Strategic National Stockpile program. Our plan is reviewed once a year with them, and the basic idea would be on a credible threat, we would receive the stockpile. This kind of thing would come in a 12-hour pushback, so within 12 hours or in up to 12 hours, we would receive a pushback with medications, some of the ones that were on Dr. McLaughlin's slide. They would come to our warehouse where we would break everything apart and send it to all. We have a plan. The plan is there that it goes out to all the healthcare facilities in the state of Alaska. All the healthcare facilities also have a plan in conjunction with this to then distribute it out to their populations based on the need.
Then I heard an error. that's fine. So it comes in. Where does it come in from? I mean, is that
this, the CDC SNS is? They won't tell us how much or where they keep their stockpiles. That's considered a secret. So that doesn't come out to the public.
Okay.
Can we know where we bring it in?
Representative Miller,
Alaska.
It's brought into Anchorage.
Into Anchorage. So that could be a while to get it out to some of our more remote locations, yes?
Yeah, it goes through the normal transport process. If there's any breakdown in the normal mode, we would then contact the state, DHS and E&M, who we would use either the National Guard or the U.S. Coast Guard to help us out in that kind of emergency.
And I'm assuming that, you know, as I look at the map, obviously some of the the places that might be in the wind pattern would be the Aleutian Islands would probably be the first that might be affected, and it usually takes a while to get anything out to those locations. Is that correct?
That's correct.
While you're there, another question is the radiation monitoring equipment. I think I heard early on, you know, that there was one coming to Southeast or something and setting it up and all that. But I mean, just if you would talk to us about that a little bit. Do we have a number of them around the state? Oh, okay. That get moved around to where they may be needed or what?
Mr. Chairperson, I think Dr. Byrne Gilley would be the best person to respond to that question.
Great. Dr. Gilley?
Yes, through the chair. We have three fixed monitors, one in Juneau, one in Fairbanks, and one in Anchorage, and they've been deployed for the past 3 years or so. And then the EPA sent up three additional, what they call deployable units, i.e. portable devices, for Nome, Dutch Harbor, and the second one down in Juneau that were just deployed at the end of last week. The devices, they actually belong to the U.S. EPA, and we act as hosts for them. This is a total voluntary program, which the feds call a RADNET. It's just to keep an overall eye on the sky, as it were, for any radiological issues that come up. The ones that have just been deployed are still in phase of being set up and calibrated. There was a little bit of issue in the one up in Nome, which got damaged during shipment, and they're sending a replacement up on that one. But everything else is functional.
Thank you. Representative Miller.
I guess we've haven't landed on this one yet. Who might be able to explain to us the distinction between the types of monitoring? I did notice that some are designed to handle gamma radiation, others beta radiation. And is there much difference between the two? And are there any other sorts we might need to be concerned with?
Representative Miller, through the chairperson, I believe Dr. Byrne Gilley would be the best person to respond to that.
Dr. Gilley, go ahead again.
Through the chair, there are basically three types of radiation that we deal with, alpha, beta, and gamma. The alpha radiation is basically your nucleus of your atom. It's a very heavy particle and has very little penetration. The sheet of paper will stop it, so it's really not too much of a concern unless it's taken internally and there are some medications that have these things bound to them that are for specific purpose. The beta radiation is basically free electrons that get ejected from the atom, and each electron, based on from what atom it came from, has a different energy level. So just because we get a certain count in beta does not necessarily directly related to sieverts or REM. And then finally, we have gamma radiation, which is pure energy, which is pretty analogous to either light energy or X-ray energy, and that has a very deep penetrating capacity. It'll go right through you, right through the building, and that sort of thing. And then the devices that are that we have deployed, and the fixed ones, they measure primarily beta and gamma radiation. That information we get on a near real-time basis. There's also a filter in these devices which have a fan which blows air over them, and they are harvested twice a week and sent to the EPA laboratory in Alabama for in-depth analysis, where they do alpha, beta, and gamma, and also speciate the type of radiation or the source of the radiation, which molecule is actually giving off the radiation.
Thank you. So I'd love somebody to play devil's advocate with me here, or you know, give me the absolute worst case unimaginable scenario. You know, if there is a large release of gamma or beta radiation, if it does get high enough into the atmosphere, if it does have the wind blowing in our direction, I'm looking at a monitoring system that you only check the filters every couple of days, that then needs to be harvested and sent off to, did you say Alabama, for analysis. That's probably going to take another day or two. And then we're 12 hours away from actually having our stockpile of medicines, et cetera, to arrive in Anchorage. It sounds to me like if we have something really catastrophic happen, we could be 5 or 6 days in responding to that. Am I close?
Representative Miller, through the chairperson, I'll try and respond to your question.
Dr. McLaughlin, just for the first.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's
Dr.
right.
Dr. Joe McLaughlin.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll try to respond to your question. I'm sure I'll ask a few others to assist with this. Worst case scenario, let's say we have another Chernobyl type event, mm-hmm. and let's say it happens in Asia. And let's say it were to happen in Japan. Certainly, we know that the reactors in Japan, nuclear reactors, are very different than the power plant is very different than the power plant in Russia, the Chernobyl power plant, in that they have very strong protective casings. They've got basically 6 inches of stainless steel around the reactor, and then another layer of concrete. Chernobyl did not have that. But let's say we had a worst-case scenario. Then we would have to look at how long will it take for the radiation plume to reach Alaska. That would obviously depend on how high up in the sky it goes, the radiation goes, and how quickly the wind is moving that plume our way. Let's say we've got the perfect storm. We've got bad wind, it's heading our way, and the radiation plume goes very high. What we would do is we would immediately request from the Strategic National Stockpile, before any monitoring data comes in from our monitors, that potassium iodide be shipped to Alaska through the SNS. And we would also be working very closely with our preparedness partners in making sure that we have a plan to get that potassium iodide and those other medications out very quickly. Depending on the amount of radiation that we anticipate seeing, the public health folks, the health department, we would make recommendations regarding sheltering in place or immediate evacuation wherever possible. So we would do all this before any before we would rely on any of our monitoring data from our five EPA monitoring stations. Now, as Dr. Gilley mentioned, those five EPA monitoring stations can receive and do receive real-time data. They receive beta, gross beta information, as well as gamma ray information. And EPA tracks that on a real-time basis. As soon as any of that radiation were to reach Alaska, we would hear about it right away through EPA. And I think Mr. Chairperson, I'd like to ask Chris Labarde if she has anything to add to that.
I think you said it quite well. You know, we do work very closely with the Center for Disease Control with their Strategic National Stockpile Program. I've been in phone conversations with them, you know, the minute this stuff was happening. So we're right there. You know, they're right there to support us, and we're right there with our, you know, reaching out to them to make sure that we can get what we need when we need it.
And Mr. Chairperson, this might be a really nice opportunity for our partners in DMVA or Homeland Security to sort of brag about the great work that they do, because they are really fantastic partners, and we rely on them heavily for emergency preparedness and response.
Right. We have Mary on in Brian, is it from there? And while you're asking, or while you're answering, they're responding. We'll get a clarification if you didn't get the question. But I'm wondering, what is there any projected effect on nearby nations, places that are closer to Japan, that we, you know, that we, you know, just the media here wouldn't necessarily focus on? I mean, do you have any information there too? Mary, are you there?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. This is Brian Fisher. I'm the Chief of Operations for the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Just to the last comment, the prevailing winds send everything, you know, towards the east and northeast, so we don't have any specific information about effects on other nations. I would add that in addition to the monitoring that Dr. McLaughlin and Dr. Gilley mentioned, there are, you know, a lot of other monitoring sources that are taking place that are outside of Alaska. You know, there's great attention being focused within Japan right now. There is the ability to have some airborne monitoring. So we're going to know, you know, we heard this morning from the Environmental Protection Agency that we're talking a couple of days before anything made its way to landfall in Alaska. We'll know more as to the amount of radioactive particles that may be in the atmosphere if they were to come this way. I testified earlier today, one of the things that we would, our plan is to establish what we call a unified command between the Department of Health and Social Services, Military and Veterans Affairs, and DEC. In the event that we were notified that there was some kind of release that could be cause any kind of potential threat to Alaska, our primary objectives operating in that out of the State Emergency Coordination Center would be to get the message out not only to the public about what our recommendations are on, like was just addressed by Ms. Labord and Dr. McLaughlin, about sheltering in place, about potential evacuations, but also to contact every individual community that's in the path directly. We did this exact same thing just a couple of weeks ago from the tsunami. We convene a teleconference. We have 24/7 contact information for local elected officials and public safety agencies in every community in the state. We would convene them. We would have the time to discuss the situation as we know it and to provide them any technical guidance that we're either receiving from the federal government or from our partners at the Department of Health and Social Services.
this emergency situation over there has provided a, at least on the positive side, has provided the drill for you to evaluate these things, and may the information you provided and the preparedness that you have never be tested. But I'm, you know, glad you're working on it, and encourage you to continue. Any other questions? I believe we're done. Thank you so much for taking time to come in and make the presentation, answer questions. We'll probably all think of questions later, and we'll be in touch if we do individually. So,
thank
with
you
that,
so
we're adjourned at 4:33.